as much information just as easily from the FEC's, the Federal Election Commission's website. But the Open Secrets is great for certain kinds of data synthesis, and it was great for looking at this. So he's got lots and lots of arms manufacturers, arms contractors contributing to him, and you notice. And this is not even me. A couple of other journalists have first started reporting this a couple of years ago. Our own Branko Marketek at Jacobin, and also the late Justin Raimondo of antiwar.com. Both of those guys looked at, into this a couple of years ago. You know, you've got Ukrainian arms dealers holding fundraisers for him, and you know, shortly after these fundraisers, you have the State Department approving these very profitable dealings in Ukraine for these same guys, and you know, and it's and then particularly now, you know, as this has as this has been going on, and the U.S. Has become more involved in Ukraine, and more explicitly so, and many of the restrictions on shipping arms to the Ukrainians have been lifted. The exact companies that contribute to SHIF in you know big dollars are making millions from this Ukrainian conflict. It you know turns out in cross-border conflicts, specific kinds of missiles are heavily used. Those particular missiles are made by Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, big SHIF donors, and also Northrop Grumman, another big donor of Adam Schiff. So, you know, he's got a lot of interest in this. He's got a lot of interest in conflict with Ukraine. He's historically, beyond this, always gotten a lot of money from the arms industry, and he hasn't met that many wars or increases in the Defense Department budget that he hasn't liked. He supported the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. He advocated for more U.S. involvement in Syria. And he's voted for almost every possible increase in the defense budget. He initially supported the Saudi war in Yemen, but was very appalled by the Khashoggi killing and has kind of, to his credit, backed off.
He supported that resolution that said the United States should not support Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen.
Yes. Yeah. So he was for it and then he was against it. So we applaud mind changing on that. I guess he draws the line at sawing up journalists with bone saws. You know, he is a moderate. So,
you know, do you think he gets, now it's not surprising for somebody who chairs the House Intelligence Committee or even the Senate Intelligence Committee or say the Armed Services Committee to be beneficiaries of a lot of money from defense contractors. Do you feel he's getting more than usual?
I think it's important context for his enthusiasm for this proxy war with Ukraine and for his enthusiasm for this panic around Russia. You know, just like the constant harping on like Russia and the Russians, which is like so Cold War. I mean, like, I'm old enough to remember the 1980s and Reagan and, you know, and how 1950s that was, you know, and
Rocky III, remember that movie?
Yeah, exactly. And so he's really, he often seems like he's trying to bring that back. Yeah, of course, they're going to give money to somebody who's in that position, but they certainly wouldn't be giving him money if he wasn't helping them so much. So, you know, if you had like Barbara Lee in a similar position, I don't think they would be that interested. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, it's the industry likes to keep giving you money if they're getting something out of it, and they're obviously getting a lot out of Schiff.
Not that it's important, but I did misspeak. I said Rocky III. It was actually Rocky IV that had the
Cold War. Oh, that
the
was Cold the War one with the
Russian. The yeah, Rocky III was Clubber Lang and Mr. T. So, you know, that's important, too.
Yeah.
Do not mix that up.
I recently rewatched that. It's amazing. Yeah.
I want to stay on the quote that I read from you in your piece in Jacobin magazine, and one particular part about it, I'm just going to reread once again. It would be admirable if Schiff's impeachment crusade was limited to Trump's corruption. By that, and this may not what you mean, but by that, do you think it's possible to compartmentalize these things to say, you know, I'm actually kind of uncomfortable about some of the rhetoric or a lot of the rhetoric that we're hearing about Russia at the same time what Donald Trump has allegedly done and using U.S. resources to in order to further his own personal agenda is problematic, is an impeach as and could be impeachable. Is that what you mean by that, or do you mean something else?
That's literally my exact opinion on this. Not that anyone conducting these hearings cares about my opinion very much, but that is certainly certainly my belief. Perhaps I'm being idealistic in suggesting that you can compartmentalize it in that way. But yeah, I do think that. Well, personally, I'd love to see Trump removed from office for all kinds of reasons beyond these corruption issues. I'd love to see him removed for keeping children in cages and for endangering continuing human existence on our planet by deregulating our environment. I mean, I'd love to see him removed for all kinds of reasons, and I don't think that the issues being raised in the impeachment hearings are unreasonable, you know. I mean, I think that there clearly is some corruption, and it's bad. And I understand why these could be good reasons to remove him from office. At the same time, I think the context, which is, I mean, I'm actually going to say the larger context, because it involves the whole world rather than just the United States. The larger context of warmongering with Russia and really trying to recreate the Cold War is something really dangerous and scary, and is would be of great benefit to the arms manufacturers that write checks to Adam Schiff, but would be terrible news for many people around the world, including us.
Well, I think we're somewhat of the same mind on that. And of course, the Democrats and Adam Schiff in particular and the people that are running the impeachment process aren't trying to win you or I over, or the anti-war left or the anti-imperialist left. But one way I've tried to explain, though, what I do think
it
is happening.
I don't actually talk about it that much. I just did this piece. I just couldn't bear it any longer.
Well, like I said, it's blown up on my social media feed. So if you're trying to stay low, well done.
No,
on radio. But no one listens to radio anymore, so that's okay. Don't worry about that.
I was mad as hell and couldn't take it anymore.
Well, he went very hard on that this morning. No question about it. That is what he was doing there. And again, of course, they're not trying to win us over. And the way I've tried to explain it, not necessarily defend it, but explain it, is first, I do think Adam Schiff believes every word he has said about that. So I don't think he's faking it. Second, is I think there is a strategy of trying to play this, metaphorically speaking, to play this game in the on the Republicans' home field, in their ballpark. because you're talking about issues around national security. You're talking about issues of patriotism. You're bringing up issues of us versus Russia. Not saying Democrats don't play a role in that, but these are sort of things that Republicans traditionally have done really well. And even if you're not going to peel off any Republicans to support you in your attempt to remove Donald Trump from office, you still could appeal, potentially thinking the long game here, the people in their districts or in their states come re-election in November.
You know, I am very skeptical of that. I'm very skeptical that I think what you just said is absolutely the reason why so many liberals and moderates really enjoy these proceedings. You know, that they're like, ha, we're getting them on their own discourse, national security, Russia is bad. You know, this is really like red meat stuff. But, you know, as I said in my piece, like I don't think this has any resonance with, you know, the kind of people who put stickers that say these colors don't run on their trucks. I mean, I think if they voted for Trump, they're still sticking with him, perhaps even more so because they might see this as kind of, an undemocratic effort to remove him. Statistics certainly show, the polling is certainly showing that that Republicans are standing by their man, ordinary voters as well as in the Senate. So I think that it's sort of I fear, and I say fear because I'd love to see Donald Trump removed from office. And I certainly think that corrupt politicians should be held accountable. But I fear it's just the liberals and the center doing this performance for whom the audience is themselves.
And liberals. And maybe that's possible. I would point out that recent polls I find are kind of interesting, especially around question of having witnesses in the trial, where even Republicans support having witnesses in the trial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, but you can want the fair, you can want the process to be thorough and fair and still be like, no, Trump should not be impeached. And like, what is it, like 92% of Republicans in one poll I saw don't think that Trump should be impeached. So that's a lot, right? I mean, like,
it's not what Nixon would have had in 74.
No. I mean, it's like it's really it just feels like very much like, and I guess I'm not really equipped to analyze whether this is an ineffectual job of convincing or whether convincing was never really the point in it, because it just definitely does not seem like it's supposed to be convincing. However, it will be effective in further greasing the wheels for our military-industrial complex and making things more profitable for the war machine to run smoothly, and that I think is pretty scary.
Liza Featherstone has been our guest, columnist for Jacobin, freelance journalist, and the author of the book Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Worker Rights at Walmart. She has just published an article for Jacobin called Adam Schiff is a Dangerous Warmonger. You can find it at Jacobin's website, or if you have at least if you're connected to sort of the progressive social media sphere, you could probably just open up your Twitter or Facebook and find it there, as I did. Liza Featherstone, I do thank you for taking time to join us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Again, this is the post show of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. I'm Mitch Jezerich, coming to you from the studios in Berkeley at KPFA. In a moment, and I'm very much looking forward to having a conversation with Manisha Sinha, who is a historian. We're going to sort of talk about the history of impeachment and maybe even how this current impeachment will fit in history. I think in some ways, what is happening right now is just not for us right now, but is also for the future and how the future may look back at this impeachment, look at precedent and all kinds of things. So we're going to be talking. We're going to have a great conversation with Manisha Sinha. We're also going to allow you to participate in that conversation. And I'm going to, you know, a couple things when we take your calls is one, feel free to make a quick point about how you feel about impeachment one way or the other. And then second, if you do have a question or comment, try to make it somewhat historically related. Yesterday, we had Hadar Avram, who is a law professor, join us for the final hour and taking calls. And so today we're going to do it with history with Manisha Sinha. Before I get there, though, once again, I'm just going to pass the hat around and kindly ask that you throw whatever you can in there. And I mean, coins or dollars, not bowling or Molotov cocktails. And, you know, but again, we need to be able to raise just a little bit of money. This isn't a fund drive. We're not going to collapse if we fail at this. But in order for us to be able to continue to put resources towards broadcast during the impeachment trial so that we could have conversations that we had with Liza Featherstone, or have conversations we had earlier with constitutional law scholars about separation of powers, or the conversation we're about to have with Manisha Sinha, again, to a historical perspective. Again, my entire goal, my full goal in this process is to make it educational, regardless of how one may even think about impeachment itself. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. 439-5732 and online at kpfa.org. And to be crystal clear, because this is about to get confusing, that's the phone number to make a contribution. Okay? 1-800-439-5732. That is not the phone number to get a public comment in. 1-800-439-5732 online at kpfa.org. You can pledge online there as well. If you want to get a comment in and a question, it's a different phone number. Try not to confuse them. They always tell me, Mitch, you should never give two different phone numbers. It's just going to be hell for your producers. That's fine. Good luck, gang, as I look at them through the window. If you want to get your call in to comment on air, the number is 1-800-958-9008. You're going to be on hold for a few minutes because I want to have a nice little conversation with Manisha Sinha first. But that number, again, to get your call in to make a comment on air is 1-800-958-9008. So as advertised, I'm very happy to welcome to the program Manisha Sinha. Manisha Sinha is the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. She is the author of the books The Counter-Revolution of Slavery and The Slave's Cause. She has a recent piece not too long ago in the New York Times called Donald Trump, Meet Your Precursor. Manisha Sinha, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you back to our broadcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me just ask you, historically, how do you see this moment in time? I imagine historians, now we never know, because we never know what future historians are going to think about this moment, say 50 years, 100 years from now. But I must imagine, as a historian who looks back and analyzes the past, every now and then you must be looking at what's happening right now and thinking about how it will be seen in history. And if I'm wrong, just let me know.
No, I think you're right. Historians are extremely interested in this impeachment. And for me, of course, you referenced the op-ed I wrote for the New York Times. I saw so many similarities between Trump and Andrew Johnson, who came the closest to being impeached of any American president, that, yes, we are extremely interested in thinking about this particular impeachment and how it will be, in fact, told in history. I should also mention that hundreds of historians got together and wrote a letter, in fact, calling for Donald Trump's impeachment. So even as history is being made, historians are weighing in already about Trump's impeachment.
What's the historian's case for impeaching Donald Trump?
Well, there's several, points that one can make when it comes to impeaching Trump. There is, of course, the two articles against him on abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, and I think that case has been made thoroughly by the Democratic House managers. But I think historians are also taking a more sort of long durée view. And if you look at Trump, he has done things that has, sort of endangered literally American Republicanism, the office of the presidency, and behaved in a manner that is actually quite unprecedented, both in terms of sort of sowing racial divisions, violating human rights when it comes to immigrants and the caging of children, just the entire policies and the tone of his administration, I think, has presented a sort of an acute and present danger to the survival of democracy in this country. And that is why I think it is so important for everyone to realize that this is not just a partisan thing, or not just, conservative versus liberal versus left. This is something that I think every American citizen should be concerned about, because Trump's specific violations of the law, but also the kind of tone and policy that he has set in the White House has just been extremely dangerous for the survival of republicanism and democracy in this country.
I want to take that last little phrase, the survival of republicanism and the survival of democracy. And I don't hear many people say the survival of the, let's just say, the republic. I mostly have heard commentators and then also people participate in Congress say the survival of democracy. And democracy and republicanism are not necessarily one and the same thing. You can have both. You can have democracy and a republic. And of course, in some ways, a republic can even lessen a democracy in a little bit. And if you even take it further, even our democracy is put on, I guess we call it a leash. If you think of the Electoral College, if you think about true representation, things like the Senate, and these kinds of things. And to me, when I hear people say this is a threat to our democracy, and it may be, but I usually think it's more of a threat of a republic. And I guess when I say republic, what do we mean? And I guess the word itself is to, Rex Publica, which I think what the people are, or the public, or the people are king. But you end up, I think what we're talking about is you have a separation of powers in which no one body is actually able to take a mass, inordinate amount of power.
Right. So you do have in the American Republic a system of separation of powers and checks and balances, precisely because the founders were afraid of absolute power, the notion that absolute power corrupts and that it is more like having a monarchy or tyranny. So I do think that we can talk about the republic as a form of government, which is a representative government, but also where the government is ultimately answerable to the people, and that includes the president. So for the president to say, I have absolute power under the Constitution to do whatever I want, or for Republicans to say that impeachment is not legitimate because the only check on a president should be elections, that is simply not the way the Constitution is written or the way the American Republic has been created. We do not have a monarch. We do not have a king who can do no wrong, right? And the idea that the president should be answerable to the people, and that if he does commit, treason, high crimes, misdemeanors, that there is a mechanism by which his power can be checked and by which he can be removed, is extremely important for the survival of Republican government. So I do think that Trump's behavior and the impunity with which he has behaved in violating, you know, not just national interests and security, but national values, I would say, you know, makes it really important for us to have this process of impeachment. I don't think this is just some kind of, you know, liberal bourgeois sham. I think it is extremely important for the left and for progressive forces in this country to stand by the rule of law and to prevent our descent into authoritarianism, which is exactly the danger that Trump represents. In terms of democracy, you are right. When the Constitution was created, it was not created as a direct democracy. In fact, the founders tended to be rather nervous about that idea of direct democracy. But we've come a long way since then. There have been many amendments to the Constitution. We've had now, you know, direct elections to the Senate. Originally in the Constitution, senators were elected by state legislatures. It was indirect election. They did not trust even the people, the states, to choose their own senators. We've done away with that. And I think it's about time we did away with something like the Electoral College, which now in the United States is really operating in an undemocratic fashion. It's operating in a way to stifle the voices of the people. So if you look at Trump, you know, his is the largest losing margin of a victorious candidate for the presidency, nearly 3 million votes. And as I said in my piece for the New York Times, that really bodes badly for American democracy when the presidency is won by tactics like gerrymandering, voter suppression, and clinging on to the Electoral College as a way to sort of really undermine the voice of the people. So, you know, I know that this might seem somewhat you know, naive and optimistic, but at one point, this country has to get rid of indirect elections to the presidency the way it got rid of indirect elections to the Senate during the progressive era.
A difficult task, because that will take a constitutional amendment, except there is another way of doing it. I'll mention in a moment, but for a constitutional amendment to occur, I just don't see these smaller states that the Electoral College actually benefits by giving them more representation. And I just can't see getting to what the 3/4 of states that you need to ratify it.
Right, you know, it's a huge hurdle to pass a constitutional amendment. But I do think there might be smaller states like, for instance, Rhode Island or Vermont, who theoretically, you know, in the 18th century, they may have opposed, you know, getting rid of the Electoral College. But I think today, the states that will probably oppose it are the reddest states, the states that have made you know, voter suppression and other kind of undemocratic tactics sort of a part of their political culture. Those are the states that would oppose getting rid of the Electoral College because I think it benefits them. It benefits states with low population, you know, and certainly states in the West who are, you know, feel that this is one way for them to get undue political influence in electing a president. But again, you know, a democracy functions because people vote, not because land votes. And, you know, we can retain the principle of federalism and having powers divided between the federal government and state governments, not endanger that, and yet go with direct elections. But you're right. I mean, it may be a bit pie in the sky right now because this is something that is not possible given the current political sort of layout. But it is something that I think American citizens will be forced to consider more and more as we come to the point where the system becomes fairly dysfunctional in terms of electing people to office who are not necessarily winning the popular vote, losing it by large margins, and then who prove to be extremely destructive, like Trump.
And then there's another track, actually, that some states are have already said that they would do if they can get enough other states to join them. And I'm bringing this up because every time I talk about this issue, I get emails from folks, but there's this other way. And that is states saying that if enough states get on board who would say that they would throw all their electoral college votes for the candidate that actually wins the popular vote, then that they would do it too. So it would require many more states to get involved, and I think even California is a part of this process, that we would throw all of our electoral college votes towards the winner if there were enough other states that would be willing to do the same to give the electoral college to reach that threshold to select a president. So we'll see what happens with that as well. We are speaking to Manisha Sinha, who is the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. She is the author of such books as The Counter-Revolution of Slavery and The Slave's Cause. Her latest piece, or recent piece in the New York Times, is called Donald Trump, Meet Your Precursor. Manisha Sinha, I want to go back to something you said earlier because I think it was very important, and that is just about, and I think it really we're talking about Article 2 of impeachment concerning the obstruction of Congress. During these 3 days of oral arguments from Democrats, it has vastly been dominated by the issue of Article 1 concerning abuse of power. And I'm not trying to take away from the importance of that, but what really interests me as somebody who follows government closely and who, I'm not a historian, but I like to describe myself as a history enthusiast, and is about precedent and how things change and then, you know, and turn in different directions, and the precedents we set now will have long-term consequences that will be used again and again. And that to me is where this second article of impeachment is really important, and what happens if the president is able to, if this strategy to just put out a, you know, a blanket obstruction from even participating in the impeachment process, other than having his defense team make oral arguments, if this is successful, what that could mean for the future could be quite damning.
Yes, I share your concern about this because, you know, when the a president in the White House stonewalls and does not answer subpoenas and actually directs government officials not to cooperate with Congress in its investigations, then they are literally defying the rule of law. They're saying we are above the law, which is extremely dangerous. No one should be above the law. If the president clearly and demonstrably has committed a crime, that should be investigated, and all the evidence should be uncovered, and certainly he should be allowed to mount a defense of his actions. But to literally say that we will not cooperate, that we will not hand over any documents or hand over any evidence and put yourself above the law, that I think is a gross violation of the Constitution and a complete misreading of the idea of executive privilege, which should be invoked only when, you know, national security is involved, not the private interests of the president. So even Nixon, when he refused to hand over the Watergate tapes, Republicans in Congress accused him of obstruction of Congress and were willing to impeach him on that. Of course, he resigned before his trial could get underway. But it says something about the decline and degeneration of the Republican Party that there's scarcely a senator available who does not see this as really troublesome, that the president would defy subpoenas from Congress, would decide that he is simply above the law, would hide evidence, would refuse to give up documents and evidence, and even, you know, intimidate witnesses and just get away with it. I think that would be horrible. It would be a horrible precedent. And even if this does happen in the end, that he is acquitted, because I don't see the Republican Party as suddenly finding its conscience right now, you know, there's still history to sort of go back and say this was was a bad thing, that this was a wrong turn, and that somehow the Republic needs to correct.
I mean, this is only the third presidential impeachment in U.S. history.
Right. Exactly.
And we know about Andrew Johnson's. I didn't until recently, but now we know about Andrew Johnson's impeachment. We know about Nixon's impeachment. We know about Clinton's impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, out of all those impeachments, I mean, Trump's impeachment smacks of, you know, the criminality of Nixon's impeachment, where he tried to interfere in an election. And in order to, you know, gain an unfair advantage over his opponents, his criminality, if anything, rises higher because he's invited foreign interference into this. And it's a lot like Johnson's, too, because in terms of a complete lack of character and playing on racial divisions and defying Congress, he's a lot like Johnson. So he sort of embodies those two impeachments. And the fact that it's been so rare in American history is that even though we've had mediocre presidents and some that have really not done well at all in the office of the presidency, we've rarely had presidents who are out-and-out criminals, who completely defy the law. And that's why it's been so rare.
Yeah. We have a number of callers on the line. They've been quite patient, just asking them to be patient for one additional minute as I remind folks that, again, we're putting out a plea and passing around the hat for any kind of donation that you can afford, one that's according to your means and one that you will feel good about as you go upon your day afterwards. In order for us to be able to do this kind of coverage, to have these kind of conversations during this impeachment trial, we need to raise a little bit of money that will make it possible. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. I'll give that number again. You can also go online at kpfa.org. The number 1-800-439-5732. Again, we are in conversation with Manisha Sinha, who is the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut, author of such books as The Counter-Revolution of Slavery and The Slave's Cause. I'm going to allow you to make and try to make them quick. We want to get through as many calls as we can. If you want to make a comment about your overall impression about impeachment, we're going to allow for that. And then if you can, you know, try to frame it to a historical analysis or question, that would be proper for what we are doing this hour. We're going to begin with Stan in Oakland. Good afternoon, Stan. You are on the air.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
All right. First off, Mitch, I'm pleasantly surprised because there's been too many people like Karen Greenberg on the air, not you necessarily, to have somebody that sees the reality of the warmongering of some of the Democrats. I hope you'll have her on again. I hope other programmers will have her on again, and Lisa Featherstone, that is. And I've sent it out to dozens of people via Facebook and also email. Okay, now for a historical thing. One of the things that also drives me crazy, besides the very right-wing tone of the impeachment process, and I'm for impeachment, but I agree with Ralph Nader, there's 10 other crimes that are far greater than anything he may or may not have done in the Ukraine.
They just didn't have the votes for those.
Well, whatever. I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, you do or you don't, right? And you remember they did vote on Al Green's impeachment resolution over the summer. And they just didn't have the votes to pass it.
Well, okay. Let me continue. Anyway, one thing that's driving me and other people crazy is the constant references to the frame and really all reverent tones of the framers, the founders, and so on and so forth, or our great democracy. Well, any KPFA listener knows 1776 did not form a democracy. African Americans were disfranchised, Native Americans disfranchised, women couldn't vote. And also, of course, many lower working class or peasant farmers couldn't vote. So I just wonder what your guest thinks about that, in the sense that, you know, it was more like a democracy in the sense that South Africa was a democracy during apartheid. That is, whites could vote. Whites had some representation, but Africans and Indians did not.
Appropriate question, Stan. I appreciate that question, Stan. Manisha Sinha, do you want to take that on?
Yes. Yeah, so when the Constitution was written and when the Republic was founded, then there were property holding qualifications for voting in most states and throughout the country. But in many cases, there were no racial qualifications. So if you were a free black man in the North and you owned a certain amount of property, you could actually vote in the early Republic. What changes in the 19th century with the rise of Jacksonian democracy is each state starts getting rid of those property holding qualifications for men. Remember, of course, women or women's suffrage was not debated as a big issue, even though there were some women who were demanding the right to vote right when the Republic was founded. But when you have the rise of Jacksonian democracy in the 19th century, many states started doing away with property holding qualifications. But interestingly enough, they started instituting racial qualifications. So you had states like Pennsylvania and Connecticut, which actually took away property holding qualifications, but introduced a racial qualification saying you would have to be an adult white man to vote. So you had universal adult male white suffrage. This is what was called the white man's democracy. In New York, they actually took away the property holding qualifications for white men, but retained it for blacks. So if you're a black man, you had to own $250 worth of property, which was a lot in those days, in order to vote. And it was an effective way to disfranchise black men. So yes, America was not founded as a democracy. It was founded on an elitist principle that citizens should be economically independent in order to vote. Because those are the only citizens who, according to traditional Republican theory, have the capability of putting the common good above their personal self-interests. And they did not think that workers, working class people or wage workers, women, children, servants, had the ability to do that because they were not independent economically, that they were dependents. It's a very elitist idea. If you think about it, it's an undemocratic idea. But as the system of representative government has unfolded in this country and gone through all these twists and turns, and with radical social movements demanding the right to participate in American democracy, you've had the gradual broadening of suffrage. Now, with the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, all opposed by Johnson, not the 13th, but the 14th and the 15th Amendments, you did have, finally, black male citizenship, black men, adult black men, at least at that point, for a certain period of time during Reconstruction, could vote, and you did have some form of an interracial democracy. So it is important to sort of really understand the complexities and nuances in American history, and to understand that every progress that has been made in terms of greater democracy has come because ordinary people, ordinary citizens, black and white men and women, have fought for it. It's not been handed out by elites who have always been anti-democratic and who have always sought to sort of preserve their power in various ways. And now, you know, we have a situation where an entire party seems devoted to this idea of restricting democracy again through various kind of political dirty tricks and legal mechanisms, rather than allow the idea of representative government to flourish.
I think you bring up a very important point. I think you can make a strong argument that the Constitution began as a white man aristocratic document, but over the years, through people's struggle, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, right to vote for women, there are other people's struggles that are now reflected in the Constitution.
Yes. The Constitution was remade after the Civil War, and That's another one of the undemocratic features I find in American representative government, that it is so difficult to remake the Constitution, that you have to have some sort of supermajority virtually in order to do that. But, you know, there have been instances where we've been able to do that. So, yes, you know, the Founding Fathers may have rejected aristocracy and monarchy, but they did come up with a fairly elitist formula of Republican government, and gradually even that was challenged. And, you know, the story of American democracy has always been a contested one. You know, we have to think about it that way rather than think of that, you know, kind of Whiggish linear notion of progress, uncontested notion of you know, freedom has always reigned and has just grown in the United States. That's not true. There have been very sort of hard and bitter battles that have been fought over American democracy in the past.
Let's go to our next caller, GS in South Lake Tahoe. Good afternoon, GS. You're on the air.
Uh-oh, I'm doing it again. I made it in.
I remember GS. Yeah. But we're allowing it to happen again, sir.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, it wasn't that we didn't notice.
Oh, yeah. Well, I thought I'd get in under the radar. No, I want to reiterate the point that you've made. It's a wonderful feeling to be a sustaining member. I recommend it highly. I support KPFA, KPFK, and one other nonprofit radio station you may know of in the San Francisco Bay Area. Anyway, yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
I'm hoping for the best here. I'm trying to be lighthearted about all this, and I have this image in my mind that Trump will be convicted by the Senate and removed from office. And in a sort of a cartoonish way, I asked this question, and it's actually a two-part question. What would happen if Trump literally refused to leave the Oval Office? How would he actually be removed physically, and by whom? That's it.
Well, let's even expand that a little bit. We'll get to that precise question. But, I mean, you know, I have, Manisha Sinha, been asked many times from people, what if the president refuses to leave if he loses the election? I mean, could he become a dictator?
Well, you know, that is quite a nightmare scenario. And Trump has jokingly suggested that he would be there forever, God forbid. But, you know, if he is indeed, you know, convicted by the Senate, which I think actually is highly unlikely, you need a two-thirds vote in the Senate, and the Republicans don't show any cracks. There may be, you know, some moderates who might, but I really think it's highly unlikely that we'd get the two-thirds majority. But I like your optimism, and if indeed two-thirds majority does vote to convict and remove him and he refuses to leave, then in fact it would be Mike Pence, who's the vice president right now, and frankly I don't look forward to a Mike Pence presidency either, but it would be President Pence who would be sworn in immediately as the Chief Justice, would swear him in as a president. He would then be the commander-in-chief, and he would actually, it would be his duty to forcibly remove Trump with the help of the armed forces of the country if he refuses to leave. But that is just such an unlikely scenario. And
what it reminds me of, and this is a little apples to oranges, so forgive me for that. It's not a perfect comparison. But you know what happened in the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson was impeached technically for a violation of this very obscure act that later would be seen as unconstitutional, the Tenure of Office Act. And what pursued before that is this dramatic story of Andrew Johnson firing the War Secretary Edwin Stanton, who was, you know, one of the best friends, I think, to Abraham Lincoln. Edwin Stanton refused to leave office because of the Tenure of Office Act. Andrew Johnson technically needed the Senate's approval to fire a cabinet member, but he did it anyways. who his pick, Lorenzo Thomas, to replace him, comes to say, Edwin Stanton, you're no longer Secretary of War. I am. And then Edwin Stanton says, I refuse to leave. And he basically barricaded himself in the War Department building, which I think was the Eisenhower office building, for like 3 months.
Yes, he did. He actually refused to leave his office because he felt that he was following the law of the land, too. The Tenure of Office Act, which reined in and which certainly encroached on executive privilege in terms of hiring and firing his own cabinet. But the reason why that was passed was because Johnson had been interfering in the Reconstruction plans of Congress, and Stanton was the one who was overseeing Reconstruction in the South at that time. So it was the law of the land at that time. So technically, Johnson had violated that law. But those were just the first 9 articles against Johnson. The last 2 articles were a lot like the articles against Trump, you know, abuse of power, obstruction of Congress. And in that sense, you know, they were somewhat similar. But you can have scenarios like that. There's another one when Lincoln was elected president. There were some southern states who were willing to invade Washington, D.C. and forcibly remove him from the presidency if he ever came near the White House. They were getting ready to, you know, those plans didn't come to pass. In the end, the South decided that they would just reject the results of an election and commit armed rebellion against the Republic. We forget why, you know, the slavery certainly caused the Civil War, the divide between the North and South, and the reason why the South wanted to secede was because they thought Lincoln's election presented an existential threat to the existence of slavery. But we forget sometimes that they did it in reaction to an election, to the results of a presidential election.
That's right. It was like the day after the election or something. They just started to secede from the
South
Union.
South Carolina, within a month, was gone from the Union. And by early 1861, the entire Lower South, and you had the formation of the Confederacy. So this idea of rejecting the results of an election, that was the immediate cause of the of secession and the Civil War. It has happened in the United States before. People forget that, you know, our democracy survived that, but that it is, it's not as if there hasn't been violent challenges to the existence of the democracy, of representative government and of results of elections.
And to be clear, the Republicans' platform in that 1860 election was not abolishing slavery. It was just saying we're going to respect slavery where it is. We're not going to allow it to expand.
Exactly. It was the lowest common denominator of anti-slavery. It was against the expansion of slavery to the West. It was not for abolition, even though most abolitionists and most anti-slavery people got behind the Republican Party and basically thought that that was their best chance to present a real political challenge to slavery. I should also mention that there are historians today like James Oakes who argues that this non-extension of slavery plan was ultimately geared towards abolition. It was the idea to sort of encircle the South with a lot of free states and literally squeeze slavery to death where it existed in the South. So even though they were saying that, you know, constitutionally we are not attacking slavery in the South, the non-extension plan was a plan for ultimate abolition. That is Oakes's argument.
Let's go to another caller. This is A.T., who is in Hayward. Good afternoon, A.T. You are on the air.
Oh, yes. This is very difficult to stomach the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party. They want witnesses, but they refuse to accept any witnesses in the House from the Republicans. This is a continuation of the Russophobia that started with the Special Prosecutor Mueller, and they failed, and now they keep on going. When we look at the House, because this one in the Senate is very boring, but in the House was very interesting because we saw the display of the deep state. we saw a Ukrainian military intelligence officer, Lindman, who worked for the United States. We saw ambassador in Ukraine, Yovanovitch, also U.S. ambassador, a Russian. We saw Fiona Hill, an English woman, and another Englishman, I think, was Holmes. And we also saw Goodman.
Antonio, our time is short. Do you have a question?
No, come on.
All right. Thank you for your call. Do you want to comment there in any way, Manisha?
I mean, the idea that the Republicans have not been given a chance to present their witnesses is simply not correct. They have had a chance to do that. They have simply refused to do it themselves and then blame the Democrats for not allowing them to have witnesses. So it's kind of a strange idea. And we should remember, and this is especially important for those who are immigrants and naturalized citizens of the United States, that both Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who has won a Purple Heart fighting for this country, and Dr. Fiona Hill are naturalized citizens of the United States. And to cast aspersion on them as some sort of, stalking horses for foreign interests is, I think, it's not just inaccurate and wrong, but it's really saying things in bad faith.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to correct that and to say that these are all American citizens. They were all members of the United States government. And as a person from the left, I mean, I normally do not see these people as, particularly my representatives. I see them, yes, as representing the national interests of the United States government, but I was still very, taken aback at their bravery for giving this testimony when they were coming under extreme threat. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman came under anti-Semitic slurs, nativist attacks, death threats. He had to actually move with his family and get military protection for his testimony. So that required a certain amount of courage to do that.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I know John in Fresno had been on the line, was dropped, and then got back in. So, John, we literally are down to our final minute, but I'm going to have you come on and hope that you can say what you're going to say pretty quickly here. Good afternoon. You're on the air, John.
Thank you. And I think I favor impeachment for a long line of bad decisions, but the question I want to ask the historian is, if the climate scientists are right and we don't have a lot of time, what's the use, the value of this as precedent if there's no future?
So, all right, John. Way to send us off, John, in Fresno. Right. Manisha, do you want to take that on at all?
Well, when we have apocalypse staring at us in the face, then what's the point of anything? But as human beings, we need to live our lives and we need to live it as well as we can. And I think actually it is really important to politically defeat Trump and the Republican Party in order to address this dire threat to humanity, climate change. I'm all for the Green New Deal. It's a Green New Deal or we won't survive.
Manisha Sinha, I thought this worked out great for us. I thank you. Manisha Sinha is the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of such books as The Counter-Revolution of Slavery and The Slave's Cause. Manisha Sinha, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Friends, today coverage was produced by Deanna Martinez. At the controls are Kyle Gustafson. Production assistance has been provided by Jean Froger, Scott Baba, and Tanea Landry. Let me go back to Jean Froger. We're a little bit sad today because it's her final day that she will be with us as an intern. Not only will we miss her free labor, we will also greatly miss the ideas and enthusiasm, and just she really helped us out a great deal. And we're going to miss her dearly, though we are excited for her on her future travels. Also, special thanks to Operation Engineering Department, Antonio Antonio Ortiz and Brian David in the news department's Eileen Alfandari. Again, broadcasts like this are only made possible, friends, if you support us. We're asking you to donate what you can. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Flashpoints. We'll be back with more impeachment coverage on Monday starting at 10 a.m.
KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. Up next, it's 5 o'clock. It's Flashpoint. Stay tuned.